only four rooms, and the largest of these wouldn't have held a congregation of more than 40. It was a sturdy edifice, though, all mortared stone, with high arched ceilings that stole up the heat even when the main hearth was blazing. The walls were covered in bas-relief from Dante's knees to a foot above his eyes, filled with hand-sized figures of bearded men in crowns and robes with stars flaring from their hands, and a number of smaller figures who appeared to be getting killed by those stars. Concealed among the kingly shapes was a frame of a man standing in a cell. Rags hung from his shoulders in abstract tatters. At his feet, three rats stood on their hind legs, front paws dangling. His outstretched hand bore four fingers. He saw Blaze no more than two or three times a day, at meals, or when the boy came in from hours of traipsing around the open wood, as he'd done when they lived by the pond. In the mornings and late afternoons of the shortening days, Dante heard the crash of swords out in the yard, mingled with the phlegmy laughter of Robert Hobble as he doled out some new lesson. Callie all but quarantined himself to his room, as if he couldn't stand sharing the same space with other bodies for more than a few minutes a day. Dante sat by the fire reading the last sections of the cycle that were still in the Malish tongue, and tried to shut his ears to the shouts and play of Blades outside. By the fourth day he could have joined them, he thought, in that he felt physically well enough to spar. It wouldn't hurt to improve his training. His current worth with the sword was about one notch above being able to take a swing without chopping off his own face. Instead, he stayed indoors. He didn't want to slow Blaze down. Robert had skill. That much was clear from how he'd acquitted himself in the field. Blaze must know that, unencumbered by Dante's clumsy swipes and plodding advancement, he could learn something that might end up saving his life, probably Dante's as well. If they thought it would do any good for Dante to be out there, they'd have asked him. So he read and reread, scribbling notes, flipping forward and backward, doing his best to place the fractured chronology in some kind of order, borrowing from Callie's bountiful stacks of blank paper to compose small essays on the cycle's curious symbolism and authorial shifts and veiled concerns. He wrote these not because he intended to amend or refute in the public arena the other scholars he'd read, though he hoped, with a desperation he could never wholly admit to, Callie would some day read them and confirm he was on the right track, but from a compulsion that felt as elemental as the stone walls and wood chairs that surrounded him. It was trying work, but it wasn't tiring. It was slow and uneven, and he was constantly frustrated by how little the words on his pages matched the ideas in his head. But he was propelled by the momentum of a boy's first found love in the subjects of men. By the end of a week, he reached the final page of the Malish chapters, before it shifted to the dead language, and in that last light of afternoon finished what he'd started an age ago in Bressel. The final times will come, as they began, blinded by the white blanket of the northern snows, settled at the foot of the tree of bone, where the dragonat spilled the father of the heaven's heartblood on the snow and planted his knuckle within the soil. The skies will be black, though it will be full day. The winds will howl with the laments of the slain as the starry vault is shattered, and all things thought past once more come forth. A scaled beast will arise with three tails and four wings and lay waste to the land. Rivers will reverse their direction, and graves will spit the dead to mingle with the living. Fire will consume the cities of man. The gift, never meant to be given, turned in hot cleansing against those who tainted its power. The beast will make himself known, lashing out with his tails to smash the false temples of men who have forgotten the true faces of the belt of the Seliset. Eric the Dragonat is dead, though he lived long, and in this twilight time he alone will not return. The beast will hold its judgment, and its judgment will be that of the scythe to the wheat. He knew some priests put great stock in apocalyptic prophecies, but Dante couldn't escape the sense whoever'd written this hadn't meant a literal three-tailed dragon was going to show up in the end days and bring a physical end to the world. It was like this story was an ancient cathedral buried up to its steeple. Men could see the spire's tip, but few could guess there was something grand beneath it, and no one could imagine what shape that cathedral might take. An understanding had been lost. Possibly the man who'd written it hadn't even understood exactly what he was passing along. This story, though, was 1,000 years old at the least, possibly many times that, told and retold until it had been embedded in the cycle. How could Dante unearth its true shape when the men who'd first conceived it had been dead for so long, none of their names survived? Where on earth would he even start to look? "Finished," Callie said, startling him from his tangle of thoughts, as garbled as the web of a whirlpool spider. "As far as I can get." "Good. Then start thinking about where you're going next, because you can't stay here." Dante's head snapped up. "You want us to leave?" "I've got my own business to get back to," Callie said, frowning at him. "What did you think was going to happen?" "I thought you were going to teach me how to read the rest," Dante said, finding his hopes sounded much less ridiculous now that Callie had dashed them. "The nether, too."
"Well, you are wrong."
"Surely you know as much as anyone about these things."
"Miles more."
Callie sighed when Dante started in on another objection. He waved his hands in front of his face, brushing it away.
"Even if I had the time, which I don't, I'm not an instructor. I was bad at it when I was young, and now that I'm old, I'm as likely to kill you as tutor you. Things are muddled. I know how to navigate my own coasts, but trying to explain it to fit someone else's mind is worse than impossible."
"Where can I go, then?" Dante said, grasping the cover of the book. "Even the Library of Bressel doesn't have the rest of it. It's like the whole world's forgotten."
"Not the whole world."
"Where, then?"
Callie's blue eyes flinched. "The Dead City. Narashtovic itself."
"That's where the Auronites wanted to take me once they saw I knew the Nether," Dante said.
He stared hard at Callie.
"You think I should go to them now?"
"Why? I thought you hated them."
"No doubt you heard some news in Wetton, about the skirmishes in the plains of Colin, the riots down in Bressel."
"What does that have to do with anything?"
"They stem from the same source as the language of the cycle's last section."
"The Dead City,"
Dante said, ignoring the embarrassment that came with using its nickname. He shuffled the pieces of what he'd learned and what Callie had told him of their motives around in the workshop of his mind.
"They mean to start a war, then.
How does that help them release Aron?"
"It doesn't," Callie said, squinting at him. "But they have this idea it would be somewhat disrespectful to restore Aron to his seat when barbarians like us still beat people to death for having the audacity to praise him."
"Have you ever seen Aron?"
"Of course not. He's imprisoned."
"Okay," Dante said.
He worried his lip for a moment.
"Have you ever seen any of the gods? One of their stellar messengers, even? Anything at all that stands as hard proof of the divine?"
Callie shrugged at him, and Dante bulled on.
"So who cares what the Auronites are up to, then? They're just a bunch of dopes in robes. They're going to sacrifice a few goats, turn their eyes to the heavens, and see nothing but the stars. Auron's not going to ride down on a flaming chariot and lay ruin to the earth."
"But they will in his place," Callie thundered, striding forward till his face was no more than a foot from Dante's. "Blaspheme all you like. Maybe Aron exists and maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's nothing but a foofara. Fine. They still believe he does, and they're still going to war for it. Thousands are going to die for it, including a few who don't deserve to."
Dante drew back, silent until the anger worked its way from Callie's face. He had a long time to wait.
"So, why bring this up?" Dante said at last. What does that have to do with me going to Narashtovik? 2 fish, 1 spear.
Will you drop the oracular nonsense and talk like a person for once?
Callie snorted, as if making himself clear would be beneath his dignity. Dante maintained his silence, and Callie snorted again, tugging at his sleeves.
What I'm saying, since during your escape you evidently sustained a blow to the head, is it may be within your power to abbreviate the coming bloodshed.
That's a load of it, isn't it? Why don't you stop it?
I know it's hardly in your nature to prevent people from bleeding, Callie returned. You're much more comfortable rupturing organs and spewing people's brains out their ears.
That seemed especially unnecessary, by the way.
The old man tapped a finger against his teeth.
It's my very power that prevents me from going there and doing something myself.
Now that's just stupid, Dante said.
It's of equal probability that you're the one being stupid.
I was known in the Dead City once. They'd no sooner let me through their walls than they were a horde of hooting savages. As soon as I got within 100 miles, they'd strike me down with a pike, then chop me into fragments, stick me on any number of other pikes, and dance around a bonfire. You, on the other hand, appear completely unremarkable and would stand out no more than any other foreigner.
Probably because I'm not any more dangerous than a pilgrim. Callie chortled at that.
I'm not about to fawn on you like those peasants you saved. In fact, if you actually believe the words you just said, I should crush your skull as a service to the collective human race. The truth is, you're a sharp young knife, and so is Blaze in his way. There's a reason sharp knives are the favored arms of assassins.
Even so, Dante said, flushing a little.
Caught off guard, these were the first kind words he could recall Callie saying. It was a second before he understood those words weren't purely poetical.
Assassins?
Well, yes. If I thought we'd have to kill every citizen of the Dead City, I'd send an army, not 2 boys. As it is, I believe we can stave off war with the death of a single priest.
There are people in the Dead City.
Callie gave him a look.
You thought it was full of talking corpses, maybe? Walking skeletons?
Of course not, Dante lied.
They just call it that to keep out pilgrims.
Callie looked blankly at the carvings on the wall behind Dante's chair.
It was sacked a few times. More than a few. After the 4th or 5th time they'd rebuilt it and plotted out all the new cemeteries, someone got wise and moved the palace inland a few 100 miles. Now Narashtovik is sort of a kingdom within the wider kingdom of Gask. A few stubborn dunces who equated their land with their identity stuck around and have continued getting sacked ever since. It's become an isolated place. Weird, in a bad way. No one goes there on purpose, and over the years it's become a shell of its former self. But there are those who still live there, including an awful lot of Iran's chosen, since in that city they could worship a stuffed donkey for all anyone from civilization would care.
He wiped his nose and sniffed.
Some do claim it gets its nickname from the regional practice the people have, suspicious of outsiders, as I hope you see why, of stringing up strangers from the city walls. But I believe it's just those little differences that make the world special.
Dante ignored him. Whenever the cycle mentioned it, it talked about a place as big as Bressel, not some horrid backwater.
Bigger? Callie said. But the cycle's 1,000 years old, and that's just the young parts.
When a text becomes sacred, you can't just run around updating it for the modern era. It would throw the whole thing into suspicion.
So what about this priest?
How did we...
Callie sighed.
Right. It's difficult to tell what kind of idiocy might be in the heads of the council. But I think if its leader were rendered persona non grata, by which I mean dead, the forces of reason may be able to cajole and flatter the dogs of war back from their madness. Her name is...
Her name? They take orders from a woman? Death doesn't discriminate, does he? Why should his followers?
I'm beginning to think you should travel to Narashtovik just to broaden your horizons.
I just didn't know a woman was their leader, Dante said.
He resolved to stop interrupting.
Samarand, Kelly said. She's not terribly old, though all you young people look alike to me. She's the wretched firebrand, always going on about how Iran's faithful have let themselves be pushed from their proper place at the table. I think if she were to stop rushing around exhorting violence and mayhem, the moderate elements would snap out of their collective nightmare and go back to grinding the radicals beneath their heels, as is just and proper.
Fascinating, Dante said. I won't do it.
Callie's eyebrows shot up.
What?
I'm not a dog of war, either. I'm not going to travel 10,000 miles to kill some woman on your say-so. Do you have any idea how insane this sounds?
You don't, do you?
This sounds reasonable to you.
No way.
First off, it's barely 1,000 miles. Second, you must have killed 12 men by now.
That was completely different.
Was it?
It seems to me a dead man's a dead man, no matter why he's dead.
We were defending our lives, Dante said.
He clutched his copy of The Cycle to his chest.
I shouldn't have to apologize for that.
Will you apologize when this war kills thousands, then?
Callie said, leaning in again. The old man looked like he should stink like a dock, but Dante was constantly surprised to find he had no odor at all, even when he was practically spitting in his face.
If Samarand lives, thousands will die. How will you split that hair to wash your hands of guilt?
What if she was going to kill 1,000,000 people instead? The entire world? Would you do something then?
Stop it, Dante said.
He stood up and faced Callie, meeting the man's age-honed glare with his own raw outrage.
Find someone else! This mess is none of my concern!
He started back for his room. He didn't know where he would go, if not Narashtovic, but he'd begun to understand just how large the world was once you learned to face the fear of leaving everything you knew behind. There were way too many kingdoms, baronies, chiefdoms, and rogue cities out there for all knowledge of the cycle to be confined to Narashtovic. He was only 16. It galled him to have to wait a single day to read the rest, let alone however many months or years it would take him to track down a Malish translation on his own. Or, he supposed with an inward groan, to learn whatever foreign language it might have been translated into. But if nothing else, a period of far-flung wandering would give the Aronite some time to forget him, to stop hunting him through the towns and the wilds and go back to their own business.
Mardon is real, Callie said from behind him.
Dante closed his eyes, hand on the handle to his room.
A huge tree, grown out of bone, is real.
Yes.
Sprouted from Tame's severed knuckle and watered from his gushing heart.
I'm a few eons too young to know that, Callie said. Nor do I know whether its limbs bear the waters above the world, while its roots rest in the waters beneath the world, as the book would have it. But I have looked on it.
Dante turned then, knowing it for a ploy, but unable to stop his pulse from thumping till he could feel it in his chest and in his ears.
What was it like?
Callie started to speak, then shook his head. Looking on it was like living in a world without light and air. His eyes drifted from Dante's, lids wrinkled so hard his eyelashes fluttered. The old man pulled his lips back from his teeth. He suddenly looked immeasurably older than his 60-odd years, as old as a wind-scoured mountainside, ages older than all the years of man.
I've seen many things I'd call miracles, if I didn't have the training to know how to do them myself.
But if the gods left a single fingerprint on our world, it was in the white tree.
The book says it's north of Narashtovic, just over 100 miles.
Callie stood there, arms dangling down his sides, hands coarse and spotty and useless, as if nothing existed beyond the walls of his skull.
Is that supposed to make me agree to kill a woman I hadn't heard of till 2 minutes ago? That's for you to decide.
Callie's eyes snapped to his, some of their former light restored.
If you won't, maybe I'll find another way. Maybe I won't. But if you want to see the white tree for yourself, the road leads through Narashtovik.
Dante caught Blaze before he disappeared the following morning and arranged to have lunch with him down by the clearing with the stream that ran a couple hundred yards from Callie's forgotten old shrine. Hours later, they sat down in the tall grass, in that cool November light, listening to the stream gurgle through the rocks. It was the first time since their arrival they'd been by themselves, free of Callie and Robert bossing them around and making jokes and story references Dante almost but couldn't quite understand. As he and Blaze swore and laughed at each other's insults, Dante realized he always acted differently when he was around the adults, as if he had to be his smartest and most sophisticated, or else they'd stop listening to him altogether. And it was some time before he could make himself interrupt their breezy mood with what he'd come here to say to Blaze in the first place.
"Something's going on out there," Dante said, after a short lull following the laughter that had followed an unbelievably obscene joke from Blaze.
Blaze cocked his head.
"I don't hear anything."
"I mean, out there," Dante said, gesturing his palms up away from each other to take in the woods and the sky. "Something violent."
"If you're talking about life," Blaze said with light annoyance, "that started a long time ago."
He bit into the leg of a rabbit he and Robert had caught the day before. Dante shook his head and tried to look serious.
"There's going to be a fourth scour or something. Callie says we might be able to help him stop it."
"And you trust Callie?"
"You don't," Dante said with honest surprise.
Blaze shrugged at him.
"It's not just him," Dante went on. "I don't know what you heard while you were in the clink, but it was all over the streets. There's riots down in Bressel. Other places, too. People are getting hurt."
"City people riot over everything," Blaze said.
He plucked some grass and tossed it at Dante, one blade at a time.
"One day, they're rioting over how it's too hot. The next day, they're back in the streets about how it's not too hot enough."
"We'd have to go to Narashtovik. It's on the north coast of Garsk."
"That far?"
Blaze examined him.
"Do you want to go?"
"I don't know," Dante said, and found that though those words hid a sea of desires and doubt, they nonetheless were true.
"Do you?"
Blaze took a last bite from his drumstick and lobbed it into the fast, shallow waters of the stream.
"Whatever you want," he said. "If you think we need to go, we'll go."
Dante nodded.
"If we're going, we should leave tomorrow. Waiting will just make things worse."
"I'll tell Robert."
"Think he'll take it, okay?"
"I think he'll come with us," Blaze said,
and Dante could only nod again, silenced by an emotion he couldn't grasp and wouldn't want to put into words.
Blaze popped up, brushed grass from his legs and dirt from his seat.
"Don't tell him I told you, but he thinks you're onto something."
He laughed, ruffling his own hair.
"He wants to hop on board your wagon before it rolls off for the land of mead and honey-haired women."
"This needs to stop," Dante said,
then laughed too.
"I'm serious."
He went back to the shrine and started packing. With little else to do and possessing the brand of spirit that couldn't devote a whole day to any one thing, Blaze and Robert had hunted more meat than the four of them had been able to keep up with. Most of it was salting in the cellar. The rest was hanging from a lattice of branches they'd arranged to soak up the smoke from the outdoor fire pit, and that, so far, hadn't been molested by a passing bear. Dante gathered up as much as he thought wouldn't spoil on the trip. The nights had been flirting with freezing, giving his guests a lot of leeway, and stuffed into a sack the meat and some of the breads and vegetables Callie had smuggled in from the city twice a month. He gathered his things, his candles and books and papers and knives, and leaned them inside his bedroom door. In the morning, he'd be able to leave as soon as they'd eaten. Callie bumped into him as he was making a final scan of the temple, sized him up and offered him a slight, solemn nod. At dinner, they ate a great haunch of the boar Robert had brought in days before, and drank stream water so cold it stung Dante's teeth. The other three shared a bottle of wine Callie dredged up from the cellar, then a second, then Robert slugged down most of a third. Dante sipped from the same glass all night, rising only when Blaze and Robert staggered off to their respective rooms to sleep it off. "This is the right choice," Callie said then.
"So you say.
I won't pretend to know how to measure the value of one life against another. But there are times when it's easier than others."
"A few weeks ago I didn't know about any of this," Dante said. He rubbed his eyes. "It still doesn't feel real."
"The legends make it sound grand, to be swept into causes you have no part in. But in truth it's grim, and it's unfair, and it wears you down."
Callie stood and moved around the table to put a hand on Dante's shoulder.
The skin of his fingers was a lusterless white, flaky from the dry air. Dante didn't move.
"Take comfort you won't be alone out there, and that, whatever happens, you're doing something that will keep all these people down here safe."
Though he didn't expect to find any rest in his immediate future, Dante managed to fall asleep in little more than an hour after he laid down. They rose shortly after dawn, gathered up the sacks Dante'd packed, slung them over the three draft horses they'd stolen the day of the execution that wasn't, and since bought saddles for through the anonymous agents Callie used as go-betweens for his needs. They took up their weapons and their trinkets and their charms. Callie took an old sword from the shrine's walls and gave it to Dante, deflecting his protests with the advice there's nothing more dependable than a sharp hunk of metal. They ate a light, quick meal, then sat in the saddle in the cold morning light outside the shrine, saying their thanks and goodbyes to the old man.
"One last thing," Callie said, when they'd hit that final silence between when they'd said everything they needed and when they were ready to ride off.
He fumbled in his robes, then produced a wax-sealed letter.
"It's for an old friend of mine. He's a monk by the name of Gabe. You'll find him in the Monastery of Menoc in the town of Shea. It's pretty much on your route."
Dante took it from him and tucked it under his doublet. His gloom from the previous night had evaporated with the daylight and the knowledge they were on their way to somewhere he'd never imagined he'd see. There was a big horse underneath him. The air smelled like damp earth and was lightly cold from a rain during the night, but he knew he'd warm up once they started moving. He was glad, for the moment, to be who and where he was.
"Can't you just fly it to him on the wings of a talking crow?" he said down to the old man. "Good gods, just get him the damn letter."
"I'm beginning to doubt you can do anything at all."
"Shut up," Callie mused.
He scratched the thick grey beard on his cheek.
"Don't leave town before he reads it. He may be some help. He used to be a fairly useful man."
He bit his lip.
"If he hasn't died, of course. It's been a while." "We'll die of old age ourselves if we don't head out soon," Blaze said.
Robert chuckled.
"Then get the hell out," Callie said. "I'll finally be able to read in peace without it sounding like a war outside my window."
"We'll miss you too, old goat,"
Blaze called over his shoulder as they started into the woods. Dante turned in the saddle and waved to the old man. Callie held up his time-gnarled palm and watched them go. A cloud passed over the sun, throwing him into shadow. Dante cupped his hands to his mouth and quacked.
Chapter 9 1,200 miles, Dante figured. Between winding roads and the detour to Shea,
they could count on 1,200 miles of travel. Honestly, it sounded insane. It sounded like the kind of trip you started off expecting to lose a third of your men along the way. He shifted his seat, trying to get used to the horse beneath him. The way it bumped, the way its muscles rose with more strength than his entire body. 1,200 miles of getting jostled around by this monster. Pilgrims and caravans would take a season to cover that much ground. Robert had looked at the horses and the route and projected they could do it in 6 weeks of steady travel, not counting snow. Snow could change everything. None had stuck around Wetton yet, meaning they could count on the first 200 miles to be clear at that moment. The slow rise of the plains could be completely different. So could the weather in the valley, in the 5 odd days it would take to reach those plains. The valley almost always saw snow at some point, though some years the lower Chancet didn't get dusted until the full thrall of January. Already it was late November. Unless they could gallop so fast they turned back time, there would be snow by the time they reached the north. In that sense, it wasn't worth thinking about. It wasn't a matter of if, but when, and whether they walked or rode hell for leather, they would see snow before it was through. All they had to worry about was reaching the pass through the Dundon Mountains before it got snowed in. Callie's shrine was about 20 miles west of Wetton. They travelled northeast, meaning to intercept the northern road a safe distance above town, and follow it as far as they could into the mountains. They rode with no particular hurry, both to give Dante and, to a lesser extent, Blaze, the chance to learn how their horses reacted to their commands before trying anything fancy, like moving faster than a walk. Dante had done some riding back at Calais, but by and large the ways of a horse were as foreign to him as those of the kneeling. 1,200 miles. Plenty of time to figure out just how crazy all this was. He pulled his cloak around his shoulders. It had grown thinner and more ragged since the night he'd stolen it off the body in Bressel. Poorly mended and open to the wind. They'd need sturdier clothes. Take care of it all in Shay. Callie's friend, nice thick cloaks and blankets, fresh food, maybe even a night in a real bed. Blackbirds and robins and crows twittered and coughed. Squirrels and rabbits and larger things crackled among the fallen leaves. The song swung up into the sky and pierced through the bare branches, warming their bodies. They didn't talk much. No sense throwing out their voices on the first day.
"Good to be out of that place, huh?" Robert said, after an hour or so. "I was starting to get the stir-crazies," Blaze said. "Something off about the old man."
Robert let the sunlight fall on his upturned face.
"Appreciate his help, but I won't miss him."
"He helped more than you know," Dante said.
"No doubt about that. Just not my sort of company."
A stream crossed their path 2 odd miles on, and they dropped down to drink and let their horses do the same. Dante watched Robert walk up to the stream and stoop to scoop water into his mouth.
"You don't walk funny," he said.
Blaze and Robert exchanged a look and a laugh.
"Fine,"
Dante drank, flexing his fingers against the cold.
"It's just a name," Robert said.
"Pretty weird one." They stretched their legs, then got back in the saddle. Robert spent a few minutes rubbing his beard.
"I'm 30-some years old now," he said to no apparent cue. "Couldn't say for sure. Split the difference and call it 35. Back when I was a young man, a couple of years your elder, I'd been at the pub long enough to be feeling right, when I stood up to go tap my private keg and found my right leg was completely numb. Been sitting on it a while, I guess, and when I tried to walk, it just dragged along behind me. Couldn't feel a damn thing."
He chuckled, running his fingers through his beard.
"Earlier that night,
I'd thrown some lip at a man I'd just met, one of those loud, boastful men who's always watching to make sure everyone's watching him as he goes on about the strength of his arm and the speed of his blade and how big the tits on the last one he banged. The kind you want to stave in their head just to shut them up. I just offered my opinion on the likelihood of a canine presence in his maternal lineage, but him being that kind of man and all, he didn't see the restraint I'd employed to keep our differences purely verbal. Well, fellow sees me stand up, or more rightly, hobble up between the booze and my leg, and then limp around the room trying to get back the feeling. He sees his chance. Not only am I drunk, but evidently I'm lame. Chance to take back his honour without sticking out his neck. Even a man fundamentally scared inside, as him, thinks he can best a lamed drunk. He comes up, and at once I see the murder in his eyes. Spend enough time at pub, and you develop an eye for that pretty quick. Anyway, without a word, I've drawn my sword, and he's drawn his, and we're squaring off. He's dancing this way and that, right and left, taking pokes at me, trying to get me off my balance. I've got half a mind to what he's up to by then, and bide my time, letting my leg wake back up. Drunk as I was, I knew I wasn't in any real danger. He was decent at best, but I was good, damn good. Doesn't take long before my leg's tingling, and just a few seconds after that, it's hurting a bit, but I knew I could move it just fine. I kept up the act, shuffling around the same spot, letting him build his spirit, and soon enough he's taking this big swing meant to open my defense for his backstroke. I jump aside like quicksilver on a griddle and strike for his heart. The man chuckled some more, gazing back through the ears. It was clear he'd told this story often. Dante guessed this pause was part of the telling. Well, for however clear my thinking, however swift my sword, I was still about half a mug short of stinking, and my blade just went through a lung and a few other parts that will kill you, but not exactly clean, like a good whack through the ticker. I kicked the oaf off my sword, and he fell down and gave me a look like I'd cheated him at cards. "You're no cripple," he gasped. "And you're no swordsman," I roared back. The crowd cheered and rolled them out in the street to die somewhere else. They bought me so many rounds I don't remember much else. Just when I woke up the next afternoon and slouched back in all scared for the watch, the crowd cheered again and hailed out, "Robert Hobble!" Dante joined their laughter. Robert hadn't meant what he'd said about Callie, he'd decided. He'd just been talking. "Tried that trick a few times after that," Robert added after they'd settled down. "Every time I realized I'd caused some serious trouble, which wasn't half so often as when I'd actually gotten in the stew, then I'd catch that look in their eyes and I'd start limping around like a man without a foot. Men are like dogs when they see a man's got something wrong. They'll tear him apart just for being broken. If you can get them to come at you, thinking you're somehow less of a man, you'll live a very long time." "Didn't they catch on after a while?" Dante said.
"Sure did," Robert said.
He winked at Dante.
"Every man in every pub in Wetton knows my name now. These days when I insult them, they just laugh it off. Imagine that. I have to leave my hometown just to get in a fight."
"It's a cruel world," Dante said. It wasn't hard going, but it was slow going. The horses were used to clear fields and ploughed dirt, and hadn't yet loosened up to the disorderly rubble of a forest floor. Dante kept his eyes sharp for sign of the road. Once they reached it, they would be nearly 2% done with their trip. 50 times as long as that, and they'd be in Narashtovik. They'd hardly been in the saddle for any time at all. 50 times nothing was still nothing, wasn't it? Robert stopped them for lunch a little after noon. They tore at strips of salted rabbit, gnawed on lumps of bread that still had some give to them. Dante wandered off a ways to urinate. On the way back, he saw a gleam of white within the grass. He knelt beside it. Bones. Sharp teeth. something small. A cat or a ferret. Just a little dirty black fur sticking to the delicate sweep of ribs. He reached down and brushed away the fur. It was dry as old hay. He could see one of the horses nibbling a tuft of grass back where they'd stopped, but couldn't see Blaze or Robert. He got out his knife, wondered what he was doing, and dimpled his left thumb until a tiny blot of blood sprung up on its end. He wiped it along that knobbly white spine. Black flecks leached from the earth and onto the skeleton. The bones shifted as if in a stiff wind, and then the thing was on its feet, narrow skull pointing its sockets at his. He grasped it under the ribs. Tendonless, fleshless, how did the legs and paws stay stuck to the body? And stuffed it in the deepest pocket of his cloak. It hung against his body with a cold weight. Dante brushed off his knees and rejoined the others. They were waiting for him, already mounted.
"Find anything interesting?" Blaze called down from his horse. "That's gross."
Dante pulled himself up, careful not to crush the slender construct against his body. He ducked the low claws of branches. The trees were getting shorter, he thought. Younger. Within a mile, they could see the road. 100 yards out, a grassy gap in the midst of the woods.
"You boys see anything odd down there?" Robert murmured, lowering his head to peer through the skein of branches.
"Yeah," Blaze said. "Traffic."
"It's a road," Dante said.
"It's 10-15 miles from Wetton,"
Robert said, tracing the road as it arced to the south.
"How many people you seen pass in the last 30 seconds?
"I don't know. 10?
"Where are they going?"
Dante inhaled. What did that mean? Was he supposed to be able to read their thoughts? What had Blaze been telling them? He was right about to say something nasty about the nature of the roads when he saw it.
"North," he said. "They're all going north." "Funny, isn't it?"
They watched a while longer. The traffic didn't slow. Dante stopped counting after 50. Robert raised his eyebrows at them and nudged his horse forward. They cleared the last line of trees and angled their horses down the shallow bank leading to the wide, well-packed road. A few of the people looked up with dirty, sooty faces. Dante glanced north. They speckled the road like rabbit droppings, going on until the path curved and was swallowed by forest.
"Maybe we should keep overland," he said. "There were an awful lot of witnesses at the hanging."
He gave Blaze a look.
"They might even know our names." "I think they've got worse worries than fugitives," Robert said. He nodded south toward Wetton. Great grey columns of smoke billowed into the air, forming a hazy cloud in the clear sky.
"Perhaps the chimney sweeps are getting a late start," Blaze said.
Dante nudged his horse forward and flagged down one of the men on foot.
"What's going on down there?"
"A party," the man said without looking up. "The kind with fire and burning instead of wine and gifts."
He continued right on by.
"It seems," Dante said, glancing significantly between the other two, "the city is on fire." "Hey!" Blaze called, moving his horse to block the path of an angry-looking man with a sword. "What happened?"
"Oh, that," the man said, turning to the mountains of smoke as if he'd just noticed. "Someone smoking a pipe in bed again."
"Have I gone insane?" Dante said.
Blaze bit his tongue.
"Let's pretend it's them for now."
"We're on horses, you dummies," Robert said. "That makes us look rich."
He hopped out of the saddle and waved at a pair of men coughing and leaning on each other's shoulders.
"Damn city torched up, did it? Viceroy catch someone squeezing his daughter's ass and go on the rampage?"
"That would have been worth it," one of the men grinned,
The pair stopped and swayed in the road, wiping grime from their faces.
"Some riders showed up at dawn, way I heard it," the second man said. "They couldn't have done all that, though."
"Are you forgetting that enormous mob?" the first said. "I haven't seen one like that since the False Succession."
"Hear what they were up in arms about?" Robert said.
"I've heard plenty of things."
"Anything you believe?"
"No," the second put in. "Just the trumpets of swift-winged rumour. They're upset about the Viceroy's cut of the grain, or all the Colliners been moving in, or their wives' ankles are too fat. Maybe the end is finally nigh, and it's time for the guilty to pay for their crimes."
"Can't be that," Robert said. "We're still running free, aren't we?"
"Tame kind of dropped the stick on that one, huh?" the first man said.
"Well, nobody's perfect," the second shrugged.
The three men chuckled.
"I'll tell you what I saw,"
the first one said, squaring his shoulders.
"I was walking down Ballshag Street when all these people started boiling out of the temples. I can understand someone coming out of church angry, but they had weapons, right? Swords and torches and flails. There was no one sect, it was all of them. It looked like they were fighting each other. A priest of Gashin was punching another man in a red robe anyway. That's when I started running. I don't know what's going on, but it started in the temples."
"What's new?" Robert muttered.
They exchanged agreements and spent a silent moment gazing at the smoke hovering above the southern forest.
"Well, we'd best be on our way.
Say, what's your name, friend?"
the first man asked.
Robert leaned in.
"Robert Hobble," he said from behind his hand. "And I'm Lyle's no account brother," the first said.
"The one who still lived with their mom while Lyle was out talking to the gods," the second added.
Robert began to walk in a stiff-legged circle, mumbling curses like a confused drunk. He stumbled, waving his arms.
"I thought they'd hanged you," the first man said, folding his arms.
"Never underestimate the power of bureaucratic incompetence," Robert said.
He reached into a pocket of his cloak and shook out a couple time-tarnished chucks.
"Here, friends, don't let that trouble catch up with you."
They doffed their caps. The second bit his lip and grinned.
"You off to clear it all up, then?"
"Nah," Robert said, raising a doubting brow. "Too much anarchy that way, Lies. People with no respect for the law scare me."
They laughed again, then clasped Robert's hand and started back down the road. Robert grinned and pulled himself up on his horse.
"Well, as usual, it's the clergy's fault," he said.
"That's what we're going to stop," Dante said. "We're 2% of the way there."
"Sounds horrible when you put it like that."
Robert sighed, then brushed off the mood like dirt on his sleeve.
"I suppose that means we ought to hurry."
"Indeed," Dante said, looking north on the hundreds of miles of mountains and rivers and snowfields between them and the dead city.
"Let's haul ass."
Night came quickly. They'd made another 20 miles along the road, then spent the twilight penetrating far enough into the woods to where they could light a fire without drawing the attention of the bedraggled masses that kept coming out of Wetton. The sun disappeared behind the trees and the hills of the west, and they brought in the kindling and roasted some of the uncured meat they'd taken along. Considering all they'd done was ride, Dante was shockingly tired, saddle raw aching. More than a month of this to go. Wetton was already burning. He had no idea whether the other local militias would be enough to quash this thing, whatever it was. This unrest and whatever they were trying to accomplish with it had roots as long as a river. They'd hidden for years, keeping their memory alive in the minds of the people, and finally, for reasons he couldn't guess, they'd taken this thing back to the open. They were ready. Dante had no delusions they'd ride into Narashtivik in a few weeks to find Samarand and all her people had fled to exile or been executed for their perfidy against the Southlands. The fight would only get bloodier before order showed its sheepish face. Dante hadn't told the others the full nature of their mission, that they were travelling 1,000 miles to kill some old woman. He'd just said they had to get to Narashtivik and go from there. Neither Blaise nor Robert were the kind to get too worried for details or complicate things with their own plans. He had the impression they thought of life as something like the act of riding backwards on a pell-mell horse. They could guess where they were likely to head next by the things they saw whipping past their heads, but who could say for sure? And in any event, they'd certainly be there soon. So what was the point of turning around and taking up the reins? The horse had done well enough so far. Why mess with a good thing? They made low talk around the fire. Robert thought they'd made good time despite the slower trek through the woods and the careful path they'd had to weave around the foot traffic on the road. He looked up to the flat sheet of clouds that had rolled in during the evening and grunted.
"Daylight's a little scarce this time of year," he said. "So long as we've got a road to follow, we ought to get our start before dawn."
Dante watched the subdued fire burn against the darkness.
"If you think it's safe." "What? Marching before dawn?"
Blaze crooked the corner of his mouth.
"Growing boys need rest. If not for me, think of the horses."
"Sun sets by 6, Robert said. "There's no reason to stay up past 8. That should give you plenty of time to rest your weary bones."
8 o'clock? Even Callie burned the candle later than that, and he'd make a dead log look spry.
"Every second you spend yapping is one more second you don't spend sleeping," Robert said.
He wiggled down next to the fire and pulled his cloak over his face.
"Good night."
Dante followed suit, settling down upon the dirt and rocks. Hard to believe he'd been in a bed the night before.
"What's a terrible thing when what's right is overruled by what's popular?" Blaze said.
"I said good night. Third time comes stamped on my knuckles."
He heard Blaze mumble something impolite, then the scratch of leaves and the whoop of cloth being thrown over his head.
6 weeks of this, Dante thought.
Nothing to it. He woke to something nibbling on the ends of his fingers. He brushed at it feebly, 3/4 asleep. It ceased for a blessed second, then bit down hard. Dante drew his hand to his chest, inhaling sharply. Before his eyes snapped open, he thought he could see his own face. He gasped and bolted upright and pulled the cloak off his head. By the faint moonlight, escaping the net of clouds and the fire's red embers, he saw the skeleton of the small predator reared on its hind legs, front paws bent at the wrist. Its pale head bobbed. He rubbed his eyes, caught another glimpse of himself, this time from the perspective of something looking up at the puzzled oval of his face. He thought he heard 2 separate winds whispering back and forth. Again he closed his eyes, and again he saw through something else's. The cycle had not mentioned that. The thing scampered off a couple feet, then turned and ducked its head. It spun away and disappeared into the undergrowth. If Dante was meant to follow it, the thing didn't have a brain in its skull. Instead, he closed his eyes, planting his palms firm against the intense vertigo of what the little beast saw as it rushed along 6 inches above the dirt. It parted the grass and scrabbled over roots and rocks, fast as a man at a run, and quiet as a bird on the breeze. He could hear no more than the most minor rustles of its claws, and through its own ears, he realized, though it didn't have any. For just a second, he opened his eyes and heard nothing at all. It streaked along through the brush. After no more than a minute, it stopped short, creeping forward until the fuzzy impression Dante received from its eyeless sockets fell upon a circle of six men in hushed conversation. It was too dark to make out faces, or even tell one from the other.
"Are you sure it's him?" he heard through the Predator's ears. "I can feel it. Can't be anyone else.
There's three sets of tracks."
"What, are you scared? They're asleep."
"We were told there'd be two. The unlocking must have driven 10,000 men into these woods. It might not be them."
"And if it's not, what's three more bodies? We need that book. The book is the key. We can't let them slip away. Larimore would kill us. I'm not joking. If we come back without it, he'll rip out our guts and laugh. He won't even bind our hands because he thinks it's funny when you try to stuff them back in."
"Weeping Lyle. You said it, man. Get yourself together. Not a word until they're dead."
Dante heard steel rasp from leather. He popped open his eyes, breaking the contact, and shook the shoulders of the others.
"Go away," Blaze mumbled.
"Shut up," Dante whispered.
Robert awoke soundlessly, sword appearing in his hand.
"Six men," Dante said. "They're coming for us. They think we're asleep."
"Then let's not burst their illusion," Robert whispered. "Don't make a move till it's too late for them to fall back."
"But there's six of them."
"What are we going to do? Run?" "Only hope now is to surprise them instead."
Dante nodded, throat dry as sand. He eased out the old, no-frills sword Callie'd given him, and pulled his cloak up to his eyes. The fire was nothing but glowing embers. He waited in the darkness, eyes slitted, ears straining. What if he'd been wrong? He dropped his left palm to his blade and slid it along its edge, cheek twitching against the sharp bite of cold steel. Blood seeped into his closed fist, warm and wet, and with it came the shadows. Leaves crunched softly as the men filtered into the camp. From between his eyelashes, Dante saw their swords glinting in the ember light. They fanned out, splitting between the three prone forms, two on each. How close could he let them get? 15 feet, then 10. Boots ruffling the dirt, eyes bright in the shadows of their faces. His throat tensed against a scream. They were standing over him then, looking down on him, processing how they'd turn him into a lump of lifeless meat. One of them raised his blade, and Robert's voice roared up then, and Dante leapt to his feet. Robert rolled away from the downward slice of a sword, and in the same motion, lashed his own across the calf of the attacker. The man dropped with a shout of shock and pain. The two men on Dante cried out, then pressed forward. Dante leveled his sword in front of him and flicked the blood pooled in his left hand at the nearer of the two. Where it landed, the shadows followed, sizzling against the man's skin and sinking to his innards. The man sunk without a word. The remaining attacker made a quick thrust and Dante fell back, offering a weak counter. The man deflected it, eyes grim in the starlight. From the corner of his eye, he saw Blaze retreat to Robert's side as Robert curled past and thrust and laid open a man's back. A flicker from Dante's front, and he jerked up his sword to prevent his head from being struck from his shoulders. Someone screamed, and a gorge of fire opened up at the spot he'd last seen Blaze and Robert. Steel clashed in a staccato smack of swings and backswings. Dante dropped to a knee to dodge another blow. His attacker hefted his blade, then grimaced and screamed as the skeletal predator sank its razor teeth into his hamstring. Dante gripped his hilt with both hands and slashed out as short and fast as he could manage. The first hit cut open the man's forearm, and he dropped his sword. The next three put him down. He turned. He didn't see Robert. Blaze faced off against a tall, long-limbed man dressed in the plain black uniform of the others, and a caped figure draped in chainmail and trimmed in silver thread. Except for a dancing white flare on Dante's eyes, the fire that had flashed up moments before was gone. He saw Robert then, stretched out on top of the two men he'd slain. He wasn't moving. Blaze unleashed a flood of obscenities and charged toward the mailed man, bowling back the one remaining swordsman.